Once the nation's richest big city, Detroit is now its poorest. It is the country's illiteracy and dropout capital, where children must leave their books at school and bring toilet paper from home. It is the unemployment capital, where half the adult population does not work at a consistent job. There are firemen with no boots, cops with no cars, teachers with no pencils, and city council members with telephones tapped by the FBI, and too many grandmothers with no tears left to give. But Detroit can no longer be ignored, because what happened here is happening out there. This is the argument at the heart of Charlie LaDuff's new book, Detroit, An American Autopsy. It is part memoir of a reporter returning home to a city he no longer recognizes, but it's also a searing expose of what happens when the promise and fundamentals of the American dream disappear. Charlie LaDuff was a staff writer at the New York Times and a reporter at the Detroit News, and is now a television journalist for Detroit's Fox 2 News. And it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's an honor. Thanks for having me on.
What brought you to write about this? I mean, obviously there was the coming back to Detroit and seeing your hometown in this free fall. But then writing about it and wanting to dissect it is quite another muscle to flex.
Yeah, and that nice introduction you gave, it's also maybe a love letter to my family, because to answer two questions, you know, my comment and your question, if you're from there and your family is there and they're struggling and they're trying to get on with the dreary business of living, then that ultimately is the motivation. These are my people. This is where I learned to read. Got my first book there, my first kiss. This is where my mom, who I challenge any of you to tell me that your mom's stronger than mine. Mm. This is the document of for generations of my family, hopefully for other people in this book, in Detroit, and ultimately, you know, having spent all that time in New York and Los Angeles and traveling around the country and the world and seeing the war zones, I just felt Detroit had something to say about this place called America, the center of the world empire, than it was being given credit for. It's you know, it's sort of a kicking boy, you know, a mutant, something out there. But as you said, once the richest city. It was 99 years and 2 months ago that GM was born, and in less than 100 years, we've come full circle. So what the hell happened here? And I figured that needed a treatment from the ground, not from on high, from the lectern, from the university study halls. It had to come from the police and those grandmothers and my brothers and the factory floor. And so that's really my motivation.
If it had not come home to you, in the sense of it is not where you were born and raised, if it is not where your mother's flower shop was firebombed, or your sister became dependent on drugs, and or your brother was working on that factory floor that you just mentioned, you wouldn't have been able to put it in such a to look through a lens and say, to ask that question that you just mentioned, what the hell happened?
You mean like raw and regular?
And yeah, yes, as opposed to, as you so rightly put it, from Mount High.
Yeah, a guy in Detroit said to me, hey man, if you weren't from here, you wouldn't be allowed to write this book. You know what I mean? Which is, I just figured there's a lot of things that I did not need to explore in the book, or, you know, in terms of the reportage, like go there, like, the auto industry and et cetera, and this many thousands of people, that in the home and the garage and the frozen peas. I didn't need to do it. What I needed to do was, hey, man, when I came up here, my mom in the 60s said, well, it was the greatest city in the world with the, you know, ice cream parlors and the Sunday drives. And then my era comes along, and that's when crack hits, and the city's wild and scary. And then it's my daughter's generation, and we come home, and it's sort of vacant and forlorn, and you wonder what happened here. And then you go back to Ma, and you say, hey, Ma, I'm starting to do some history here, starting to look at us, starting to talk to the family and become a reporter. What you were telling me was a myth. It wasn't all that great when you were coming up. She says, honey, I don't know, that's what they told me. And so the thing starts to reveal itself. It starts to reveal itself in 8 Mile Road, you know, that divide. Where did that come from? I didn't know that George Wallace, you know, Alabama George Wallace, the snarling segregationist, right. He won the Michigan Democratic primary in 1972. And then in 1988, Jesse Jackson won it. So what gives here? What happened? And I dive in, I dive out, and then what I'm really trying to show you is what life on the ground is now, what's happening with our police and our firefighters and our grandmothers and the lost ones. So
the subtitle, as I mentioned, is An American Autopsy, which would give us the indication that that you view this city as dead, or at very least dying.
That's a good one. You know, I would have called it Metro Detroit, an American vivisection, but that's not really snappy. You know, it's a title. So it's Detroit. It's blue-collar suburbs. Let's not lie about it. Listen to how you started the piece off here. Look what the children are living in. Look what the homicide rate is. Look at the corruption. When I got back in 2008, look at everything that had happened. The auto companies are going bust. Lehman Brothers goes bust. The mayor of Detroit's caught up in a sex and RICO case with the feds. Everything all at once just seemed to collapse. Now, me, you know, the kid from Joy Road, goes out into the world, explores himself, sees New York, sees Los Angeles, sees the world, comes back to this place and says, this isn't normal. This isn't normal. But having said that, the things that are going on in Detroit are going on in the rest of the country. That's not a supposition. That's a fact. St. Louis, Los Angeles, Phoenix, we can go on and on. And I'm saying, what's happening in Detroit is happening in America, and if we do it very spectacularly, but if you don't get yourself together, you don't get your money together, your family together, your political structure together, this is going to be you, Phoenix, because you don't even really have an industry. Your industry was building cul-de-sacs, and that's gone. So, I take it as it's a warning. It's a warning to America, to Baltimore. Hey, Baltimore, I know you did a study. You're going to be broke in 10 years. You're going to borrow $1 billion. Detroit did that the last decade. If you don't want what we have, you better get your act together.
But with that said, there are really no – are there any cities to look at and say, okay, well, how about you? You're a good example of what we could do in this town to make it better.
I don't know. Because now you're talking about the industrial belt. So, I mean, you know, maybe Seattle, the comeback of Boeing, but San Francisco doesn't really apply. Chicago's having difficulties. So we're doing it ourselves. So is Detroit dead? Absolutely not. We have a future. We have car companies making money now. Thank you, United States citizen, for the bailout. We have all the fresh water in the world. We have the busiest trade corridor in the North American continent with Canada. So our future's there, but to be bluntly honest, Detroit was founded, and my family included, by unskilled, uneducated people. And we had a use for them. And three or four generations later, we really screwed it up. We didn't bother to get educated very well. And now we have a lot of leftover, uneducated labor with nothing for them to do. So eventually, they're going to have to move south, very many of them, because at least there's no heating bills in Texas. That's the fact of the matter.
You talk in this book about the city and its structure and where the money is going, and it's shocking. I mean, it's really unbelievable because it seems as though everyone realizes that there's a mess, but they don't really do anything. They just kind of let it happen. And maybe I'm reading that wrong, but it certainly seems that way.
I think so. I think that's fair. You know, I mean, look, Detroit's got this is interesting to talk on the phone, you know, because your mind can go everywhere, and I'm not even sure if I complete the point, but starting backwards, Detroit's got racial problems. It's a southern town. You know, people came off the cotton fields. They came sharecroppers, and they came to work these factories. We never had our reckoning because we were the north. Detroit was the terminus of the Underground Railroad. That's what we thought, but it really wasn't like that, and they didn't teach us these things. It was very segregated. There were restrictive covenants in neighborhoods and in real estate, no blacks, no Jews, legal in Michigan until 1950. They never told me that. They never told me my great-grandfather and grandfather were black. I never knew that till I came home. And so ultimately, we're fighting this, still fighting this Jim Crow legacy up north, 8 Mile, the 8 Mile divide. In the meantime, while the working class, blacks and whites, are fighting it out, on top, the suits, the political class, the blacks in the city, and the business class, the whites, are divvying it all up. You can Google it, look at Kwame Kilpatrick, look who was bribing the guy or being extorted by the guy. And everybody just took it because everybody was getting paid, GM, Chrysler, Ford, cranking out the paychecks. You can paper over a lot of sin with money. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's no money. Now what? Well, now I walk into town, I can't believe this, and fast forward to today, I've made it my business to try to hold their feet to the fire. For once in my life, I think writing and journalism has a noble position. It can. You know, I don't have any answers. All I know is the people don't feel that the government represents them or does their bidding. I don't think they do. And I'm there with a pen, the power of the pen, to inform people. And so I like to say Chocolate City is encased in vanilla icing, meaning regular people saying black and white, them, us, we're more together than you think because the real color problem is green in this country.
You talk about
that, makes sense?
Absolutely. You talk about the power of the pen, but I do have to say, you know, the old adage of a picture is worth a thousand words. The photography that you end the book with is,
thanks for bringing it up,
is really powerful and incredible. Did you take the photographs?
No, that's Danny Wilcox Fraser. He still works in film, and he doesn't use a light meter. And that guy is like just nuts. I mean, he's great. I don't know how you can explain photographs on the radio, but let me tell you a little story about Danny. Danny's from Iowa City. Goes all over the world. Real sort of tough, sentimental, artistic guy. He comes to Detroit, he says, I'll meet you, and he takes a room on Jefferson Avenue. That's the sort of the bottom spoke of Detroit. Detroit's sort of like a circle. It spreads out from a circle. It goes east and west. Danny decides he's going to go to a motel because he wants to immerse himself. It's called the Stay Inn, I-N-N, the Stay Inn. Well, Danny should have read the marquee. He should have stayed in because he went into the lobby, started shooting photographs of, like, young people sort of, you know, getting it on. It's kind of a wild, you know, inner-city place. And the crack baron, the crack dude that was running that hotel sort of abducted him, sort of. Brought him into the room, threatened him a little, stroked him a little, threatened him a little, stroked him a little, and then told him to go sit in his room until somebody came to get him. And so Danny's sitting in his room like freaking out, man, like, oh, my God, I'm going to die. And then the sun starts to rise, and he notices the shadows and the lights die down. So Danny jumps out the window, jumps in his car, and takes off. That's how Danny got those pictures.
It's everything from an empty factory on the east side of the city to a funeral with a very young man in a casket and his friends at the side, firemen on the east side, pictures of children, pictures of old men sitting on the stoop. They're black and white, and they're very stark images that perfectly capture what you have written about in the previous 300 pages. It really does give you a sense of that we have failed big time.
Yeah. Now, having said that, a couple of things. This is not an educational book. This is not a handbook. This is it's the kind of a wild, kind of rough book. You know what I mean? It's on the ground. It's homicide cops cracking jokes over corpses. It's my brother working in a screw factory. So I don't want people to be afraid of it. Like it's going to be dry. you know. Number two, there's a saying going around now about Detroit. They call it ruin porn. You know, the photographs of our spooky and beautiful abandoned factories and homes. This is not that. Yeah, we screwed up. We did. This whole society called America, we screwed up. But we're alive. You know what I mean? And so I'm not a liberal, and I'm not a conservative. You know, I'm just one of those guys. I just feel we're on planet Earth, and we don't have to throw a whole subsegment of our society away or ignore them, or, you know, you can even take Greater Detroit. You don't have to make fun of us. We were the first up, the first down, and we're coming back, hopefully. You know, you got to be tough. My mom got my brother out of a crack house when she was 16. It was like a Norman Rockwell scene. Yo, Jimmy, your mom's on the porch. Right? My mother would not leave till she got my brother. She said, I'm not going to lose you like I lost your sister. My sister was in a heroin den. She was a late teenager, early 20s. My mother, in this raccoon coat of hers, every time she came to rescue us, she seemed to be wearing this raccoon coat. She sat on the lawn. They threatened to kill my mom. She wouldn't move till they kicked my sister out of that house. So, hell no. No, we're not gone. We're not dead. We are very alive, and these are the good things about us as Americans. And one last thing, in case my mom's listening, yeah, we were raised with God, and we were raised with culture and books, and you know, with some modicum of class, a single mom holding all of us together. This is, above all, my love letter to her.
Was it a conscious decision to stay?
To come home?
To come home and then to stay. I mean, when you came home, did you know you were going to stay?
Nah, dude, I'm going to be honest, man. You know, I mean, you get enough New York, you know, East Coast, West Coast in you, you start believing it. So I got a little arrogant. I admit it, you know, and I mean, I'm a Times man. I want to peel a surprise, you know. I didn't think I was like that, but I was. And I figured, you know, I quit my job as a national roving correspondent for the New York Times. Real great gig, credit card, you know. You can go whale hunting in the North Pole. You can cross the desert with migrant Mexicans. You can do all this. And then I figured, well, I quit because we had a baby and I was a stay-at-home dad. And then I realized we were sort of isolated in L.A. and my wife was working her career. And we decided to quit and move home and raise her child, have her be from someplace, you know. But I still was carrying that, like, I'll just float in here, I'll write for a year or two, maybe hang out with the Homicide Squad, write a book, and then, you know, get the hell out of here. And then it clicked. I won't tell you in the book what I'll tell you. A frozen man in the bottom of an elevator shaft, and he was left there, even though a bunch of people knew he was there. Nobody bothered to call to get him some dignity and lay him to rest. And I was just thinking, what the hell happened here? And then all my brothers lost their jobs and their homes. And it wasn't funny or amusing or interesting or, you know, in a petri dish for me anymore. It was my home. I was from here. And even if I left again, the place is never going to leave me. So I decided then that I was going to be part of the solution instead of just being the parachute artist into my own home. And even if I do leave, and that's okay in life, I got a new love and appreciation for the city that my many great times grandfather founded, and I didn't know that either.
Do you think that you and writing about this book can wake people up and can really be part of a solution?
That would be nice to believe, yeah. I don't know. I just think things are so vitriolic and pissy and scorecard keeping in American society anymore. You know, that not nobody, I'm overstating, but lots of people aren't thinking anymore. And they mistake watching cable TV or posting on Facebook as actually, you know, getting some information, studying. Do they really vote beyond the popularity contest? Detroit Warren, the northern industrial suburb of Detroit, was the home of the famed Reagan Democrats, the white working class who voted Republican, right? Why would you vote? That's almost like economic suicide to sort of vote for the party of NAFTA. you know, the party of WTO. That's going to hurt you. And so is there a way, can this wake people up? Yeah, I hope so, but it's not up to me. You know, and maybe a lot of people are more awake than I. Maybe I'm asleep. I really can't make that call, you
right.
know, because one, it's arrogant, and two, to be honest with you, I think it's probably coming across this phone. I'm a pretty confused dude.
Yeah.
The life's going so fast, and you know, it's such an epic. It's an epic. We're not living in a cycle. We're living in an epic, and I'm just trying to make sense of little bits of it, or maybe, you know, your many times great-grandson will read this book when he's doing his holistic look at the United States of America at the turn of the century. You know, I don't know.
The book is, it's incredible. It's called Detroit, An American Odyssey, and it is published by the Penguin Press. Charlie LaDuff, I thank you very much for being with you, and I wish you, for being with us, and I wish you all the luck in the world in your efforts and with the book.
I'm going to go outside and have a cigarette and scratch my head and wonder what the hell just happened. I'm feeling something, and I appreciate you bringing it out. I really do.
Thank you very much, Charlie. I appreciate it.
All right, sir.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Detroit, An American Autopsy. It's published by the Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.